Friends, Romans, countrymen, gather before me and be regaled for the latest accounts of the impressive deeds of Gaius Julius Caesar in Gaul. And I'll tell you what, there's a dashing man who would make a mighty fine dictator. Before we commence, I would like to acknowledge the kind patronage of Eldarius Magnus, a comics ambassador. I must confess I've never heard of that land, but if he can draw as well as he can write, it must be near Egypt. Anyway, as you may recall, the triumphant Caesar, gonna take a lot to drag me away from you, had saved the good people of Gaul from the Helvetii. But it doesn't end there. Let me tell you about an ungrateful Germanic barbarian who goes by the name of Ariovistus. These are the words of Caesar as conveyed by Rhiannon Evans and Matt Smith. Upon the conclusion of the Helvetian campaign, deputies from well nigh the whole of Gaul, the chief men of the various states, assembled in Caesar's camp to congratulate him. They perceived, they said, that although Caesar had by the campaign required satisfaction of the Helvetii for past outrages suffered by the Roman people at their hands, the result had been as beneficial to the land of Gaul as to the Roman people. For those who came in late, Caesar beat the Helvetians, who are now currently the... Who identifies as the Helvetians?
The Swiss.
The Swiss.
The land of the Helvetii is now part of Switzerland.
Okay.
Their coinage and I think stamps has coin foederatio Helvetii written on it.
Mm-hmm.
Or Helvetia, I think is the adjectival form, which means the Helvetian League Alliance.
Right.
And I believe the reason for that is so because they don't want to have French or German or Italian or Romance on there, which are the four official languages of Switzerland, because that would be prioritizing one over the other.
So they've got to try and come up with something distinctive.
They go for Latin.
They go for a dead language.
Yes. And
Sorry.
It's okay. It's still raw for me, I know. And they also go for, I guess, a native identity that actually doesn't cover the whole of Switzerland, but is something they can identify with without prioritizing one over the other, one part over the other.
Okay.
We shouldn't frame it as something negative because, of course, there's a certain... prestige associated with Latin, you know, lots of mottos and tags and famous families' mottos are in Latin. There's a reason for that.
Something tells me you're a bit biased, though.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so 130. So conclusion of the Helvetian campaign, massive celebrations ensue.
Yes, well, Caesar's very keen to tell us that all the Gallic tribes came to say great things to Caesar, congratulations, that the Helvetii had been defeated. Which is, of course, Caesar wants to transmit to us and to the Romans that he's got the backing of the other Gauls, that they saw the Helvetii as a problem. So he was sorting something out that needed to be sorted out. I think behind a lot, especially the early books, we've got to remember that Caesar technically has no reason to be there as governor of Provincia. He's not governor here. This is out of his remit.
Sure, but he was doing a favor to the locals. And they come and pay homage to him. And really, that's the entire point of Caesar's Gallic War, the works. Let's go and pay homage to Caesar. Look at this great thing that he did.
We'll see it a lot. Yeah. And often it's back in Rome at the end of a book. They're announcing their thanks to him from the Senate.
The meanwhile, back in the Senate.
Yeah. We don't get to see much of Rome, but they're often congratulating him. So there's a lot of self-congratulation going on here. Of course, it's all written in the third person, so it doesn't look like it is.
Mm. It's very deceptive that way.
The other implication of this Gauls coming to congratulate Caesar is the idea that the Helvetians, he says they try and defend themselves by saying, look, all we wanted was empire. You should understand that as the Romans. And that's meant to sound negative because Caesar has now saved the rest of Gaul from this. Of course, the irony is that all of Gaul is going to become part of the Roman Empire. So whether there's an implicit irony there and whether the Roman reader would have perceived that is hard to see. But he's certainly painting the Helvetii as the bad guys here, who are not very self-aware, who sort of try and make up these excuses for why they left their land, that the Romans have now put them back in very firmly, packed them back in their own region.
But that's an excuse that will come up against again and again, isn't it?
Yes, at various times, individual Gallic peoples seem to want to have dominion over the rest of Gaul. Or occasionally they'll make an alliance against the Romans, but much more Caesar depicts them as wanting to rise up and be, you know, the ruling Gaul, the ruling Gallic tribe. And he also depicts a place that has got these little conflicts going on. So
this is meanwhile to kind of set up the fact that this is an area that needs Caesar's intervention?
Yeah, it is that. We're kind of moving on to that. It's actually something that Caesar then brings up straight away by having one of the Gauls, a man called Diwikiacus, immediately sayable, rolls off the tongue. He's one of the Aedui. Now, the Aedui are kind of the Romans' friends throughout most of the Gallic Wars,
yeah,
or at least most of them are. And Diwikiacus comes and kind of fills in the background. He's like the chorus who, you know, tells you what's going on in a Greek play. He sets himself up as the spokesman for the whole Gallic delegation. And he says, this is the history. We've had this power struggle going on.
Oh, so he's doing the dramatic voiceover.
Yeah, kind of.
To give you context. Yeah.
He's explaining to Caesar, in a way, why he still needs to be involved in Gaul.
Yeah.
So that's why Caesar puts his voice forward. And he's very cleverly puts it into the voice of a Gaul. It is that his people, the Aedui, have been in a power struggle with the Arverni. And they've sort of both been really important and had local power amongst the Gauls, kind of authority amongst the Gauls for years. But this has now led to trouble. Because of them headbutting against each other, the Arverni, along with their neighbours, the Sequani, have decided to basically bring outsiders in to get some help, some auxiliaries, mercenaries really, to buy help from over the Rhine and ask the Germani under Ariovistus to bring Germans, as we would think of them, into Gaul in order to help with their struggle with the Aedui.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so the Germani, Caesar will often depict as extremely tough and militaristic. So these would be good fighters. The trouble is that initially the Arverni pay for 15,000 of the Germani to come in to help out. And these fierce barbarians were great fighters against the Aedui, who now have sort of lapsed in terms of their domination. But the problem was that the Germani who came over, according to Diwikiacus, they liked the soft civilization they found on the other side. There was more luxury. And so they decided to invite a whole load more Germani over. And now 120,000 have come over the Rhine. And they're kind of pushing Gauls out of their territory. So this is going to lead to similar problems. In fact, he says this is why the Helvetii were having trouble.
Mm.
They're being pushed out of their land. And it's going to lead to more of that. So he implies there are going to be Gauls moving around. And eventually, Diwikiacus says, they're going to end up in the province, in your Roman province, because they'll have nowhere else to go.
Yeah.
So he actually says to Caesar, there is a danger to your province. And it's very important that he says that to him, because that gives Caesar the tip off that he needs to do something. He needs to be there. He needs to counter these Germani.
Okay, so two things. One, is this Germani invasion forces, to call it an invasion force, is that accurate? Are they migrating? Is it all just warriors?
He just says it's a huge number of people and therefore it's going to be problematic. The fact that they come over for the civilization, as he describes it, implies that they're bringing their families over. They like the lifestyle. And Caesar always depicts this as a very kind of black and white situation where Gaul has, you know, they have farming, they have homes, they have more established civilization.
Yeah.
When he goes into detail later on, he'll describe the life of the Germani as really rough. A lot of outdoor living. They only wear skins. They have to be used to the cold. So they haven't got these luxuries. They haven't got that lifestyle that Gaul can provide.
Yeah.
It almost certainly wasn't quite as black and white as that, but it serves Caesar's purpose to describe it as such here.
We're using the term depicts a lot and speaking about the way things are put forward, which gives me the impression that you're very dubious that this is actually the way that it went down.
Well, one thing that makes me dubious is that Caesar does have this very stark contrast between these two peoples.
Yeah.
But the archaeological evidence suggests that there wasn't that much difference between the west and the eastern side of the Rhine. So he's almost certainly exaggerating any difference that there was. And he might have all kinds of reasons for this. For example, it wouldn't be beyond the bounds to consider that he wants to conquer Gaul, and he's kind of depicting it as something worth conquering.
Mm-hmm.
And also as people who won't put up quite as much resistance as the Germani would. So he kind of makes the Rhine his barrier, his border for the new provinces he's eventually going to create. And in some ways, he creates this kind of false dichotomy between the two, this false sense of difference, which, of course, we now have between, say, the French and the Germans, partly for linguistic reasons. But the linguistic difference is there because the Romans conquered the French side and brought their language in. So French comes from Latin, German doesn't. That's not the only difference. There are other cultural differences too. But in a way, you could argue that Caesar starts to create these differences in a text, which is an interesting way to create difference in culture. It's not helped, I think, by the fact that the Germans are still called the Germans and Caesar's calling them the Germani.
Yeah.
And it's very easy for us to just merge the two and think of them as the same people. So I'd like to call them the Germani to make them distinct, the ancient peoples who lived there. It's easier with the Gauls because that doesn't sound like anything like the French or the Belgians.
Yes, yeah. This is the exact same problem that Goebbels had.
Well, that's nice to know that we have something in common.
Okay.
Not really.
All right. So this is our first mention / introduction with Ariovistus, who is going to be the villain for the next installment of Caesar's Gallic War.
He really is depicted as a villain. He's called a barbarian, the word barbarus, by De Wiciacus. It's a nasty, nasty word in Latin by this period. It really means savage. And he's just depicted as cruel, as arbitrary, as he's taken Iduan hostages. The only reason De Wiciacus can speak up is because his family happened not to have given hostages. So the idea is, if Ariovistus has hostages from your family, then you daren't ask for help from the Romans or whoever else. You daren't move against him because there'd be a danger to your family members. He's also seized the best territory in the lands he's in, and a third of their territory is gone, and De Wiciacus says there's going to be another third gone soon as well. So he's acting in this really predatory fashion, according to the account of De Wiciacus.
And Caesar's first option is to negotiate with him, which I suppose is perhaps in his mind a vain attempt to bring civilization to a barbarian, but still something that as a cultured Roman he has to do. He has to give the option of negotiation.
Caesar's kind of between a bit of a cleft stick here as well. Yeah. So he words it very carefully at 133. When he had learnt this, Caesar comforted the Gauls with his words, promising that he would concern himself with this matter. He had, he said, great hope that by his good offices and his authority, he would induce Ariovistus to put a stop to his outrages.
Mm-hmm.
He kind of depicts himself as the negotiating hero here. But as I say, he can't just decide to declare war on Ariovistus, or isn't this terrible? I'm going to send my troops in. Because, as will become clear, Ariovistus had very recently been named a friend of Rome.
Yes.
He's not quite an ally, but it's along those lines. He's been named a king and friend of the Roman people by the Senate. And it's only the previous year. And that year, of course, was the year of 59 when Caesar was consul.
So it was during his consulship. It'd be going back on his own word.
It would be very much related back to him, even though it's the Senate as a whole that has made this declaration. Mm-hmm. You know, he had imperium. He had a great deal of authority at that moment. It's something that Ariovistus brings up in chapter 35 as a way of saying, you know, you shouldn't be doing this. I'm protected by this. Mm. Although we have to remember that Caesar is the one who records these words. So Caesar's doing it for his own purposes and perhaps reminding his audience why he couldn't just step in and reminding them that he's aware of that. And the reason I say this is that even though Caesar might not have known this when he wrote this down, because he might have written it in 58, not at the end of the whole war, but towards the end of his time as proconsul, as governor in Gaul, it would become clear that if Caesar went back to Rome, he's going to be prosecuted for declaring war on Ariovistus.
Yeah.
This negotiation doesn't work. There will be a war. And he will be prosecuted for fighting against someone who'd been named as an amicus, a friend of Rome. So Caesar's enemies back in Rome are taking notice of this and they're saving it up for later.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a reason why Caesar can't go back to Rome. He can't give up his protected status as a magistrate. And because the Senate won't allow him to nominate as consul while he's outside of Rome, he has to come back. So instead of coming back, he basically crosses the Rubicon with his army and declares war on Rome.
Might as well push on, yeah.
It leads to the Civil War. Mm. So that, I know we're getting ahead a long time in terms of what we've got here from 58, but it has implications down the line. And this is one reason Caesar's very clear that the first thing he tried to do was negotiate.
So did Caesar at this point see it as his duty to protect these Gauls who were coming to him, as opposed to staying on the side of somebody who's been declared a friend of the Senate?
Well, he really tries to be balanced here, because just after he's said that he's going to negotiate with Ariovistus, he mentions that the Aedui are also special to the Romans. He says they've often been hailed by the Senate as brethren and kinsmen, as our translation has it, literally kind of blood brothers, people who share blood in Latin, fratres consanguinesque. But now they're in slavery. He actually uses the word in slavery to the Germani, which is, you know, the lowest status you can have in the Roman world, and I guess in any slave society. And that's a disgraceful position for people who are meant to be close to Romans to be put in. So he's really giving the justification for why the Germans need to be fought off you.
So Caesar approaches Ariovistus, perhaps not literally at this point, with an attempt to negotiate. And Ariovistus shuts him down.
Yeah, well, Caesar makes demands. He says, kind of lists off on his fingers the things that Ariovistus mustn't do. Don't cross the Rhine. Give the hostages back.
Give me back my corn.
Yeah.
It's always corn.
There isn't corn at this point.
Oh, sorry. There's no corn at this point. That's
Caesar's
a shock.
Caesar's fine for corn.
Okay.
He's not actually fighting at the moment. We need to ensure the protection of the Aedui and the other friends of Rome. And if he does that, then he says Caesar and the Roman people would maintain a lasting kindness and friendship towards him, which is not offering much because technically he's already got that.
Yes. So are these reasonable demands, or are they demands that you hope slash assume will provoke Ariovistus just to say no and give you the excuse to wade in with a few swords and troops?
In a way, I don't think it matters because Caesar gets to win either way. He's kind of neutralized the situation with words.
If they back off. Great.
I'm sure he realized Ariovistus wasn't going to back off at this point. He sent 120,000 people over already. And if he is, as Wikiarchus describes him, if he is this cruel and fierce and angry man, then why would a few words saying you can have the status you've already got make him back off?
So he says, this is 34, it was the right of war that conquerors dictated as they pleased to the conquered, and the Roman people also were accustomed to dictate to those whom they conquered, not according to the order of the third party, but according to their own voice. So essentially, we're just doing what you guys would have done.
It's interesting that Caesar gives us this argument a couple of times from Ariovistus. I'm just doing what you do. This is my domain. I'm not going to interfere with your province, so you let me do what I'm doing here. While on the one hand, it sort of sounds reasonable, although conquest of any sort sounds a bit abhorrent to me, we're just doing what you do is a fair enough argument on one level. From the Roman point of view, he's interfering with people that the Romans have said that they will protect. And he's also putting it in a very forthright and arrogant manner. Plus, of course, for the Roman reader, their right to build an empire seems much more just than anybody else's right to build an empire. I'm afraid there is just that prejudice on their part. So they don't necessarily buy that argument as one that's viable.
They mightn't necessarily buy it, but it's in some ways giving Caesar a very credible foe to go up against. Here's somebody who hasn't been defeated, who respects the law of war, and who needs to be shown the heel of Rome.
Yes. I guess that the difference you might say as well is that he seems to be coming in and deliberately imposing tyranny. And Caesar would claim that he's not doing that.
Yes,
and that the
Romans
haven't done that to their empire because they kind of sanitized what they do in their empire. And Ariovistus is also depicted as very stubborn. And he's putting himself on the same level as the Romans. I don't think they would regard that as acceptable from a people who are savage and don't have civilization. You know, they don't have aqueducts. Who do they think they are?
But having said that, crudely put, unwashed masses, that's what Caesar's going up against.
Yeah.
Ariovistus hasn't slept under a roof for 14 years. Is that the figure?
He says that, yes. He says that himself as a kind of threat. You think you can defeat me?
Yeah.
Like you get to sleep in a tent every night or in a luxury villa at home, but these men around me, we've been sleeping rough for years, so we're tough.
It's just, look at you with your aqueducts and your running water.
Well, at one point later, yeah, exactly. At one point later on, the Germani do laugh at how small the Romans are. But you see, that's what makes it even better when the Romans win, of course.
Yeah.
They win by tactics. They win because they've got stratagem and intelligence, as well as being tough soldiers. All the Germani have got going for them, according to Caesar, is that they're big and tough and have kind of endured, bathing in freezing streams every morning, that
yes.
sort of thing.
Yeah.
They don't have the intelligence to go with it. There's a real cultural prejudice going on here.
All right, so the parley fails, and Caesar and Ariovistus essentially go back to their corners and get ready to fight.
Yeah, and Caesar hears evidence that Ariovistus intends to conquer a town, the most important town of the Sequani people, a place called Vesontio.
Contemporarily, where is it?
Kind of central northern France now. The current name is Besançon.
Mm-hmm. So it's a strategically important town. Ariovistus has his eyes set on it.
Yeah, and the quote from Caesar is that it has an abundant supply of all things needful for war.
So corn.
Presumably that includes corn.
Yeah,
I know you're
great.
Obsessed with that.
Yeah. I'm obsessed with it.
Caesar's obsessed.
Caesar, thank you.
And the place was so well fortified by nature as to afford great facilities for the conduct of a campaign. So not just that it has stuff, but it's a good headquarters to carry out the rest of a war.
So essentially it's got a inbuilt moat. The river meanders around it and almost cuts it off entirely.
Yep.
So you get that. You've got a very well-defended place.
So what Caesar does, he's done best throughout this book so far, is he gets to a place really quickly. Mm. He gets there first. He puts a garrison there. He does run into trouble, though. We're at about chapter 39 by now, because the Gauls have all of these rumors about the Germani and how scary they are. There's this whole rumor mill that they're giants, they're monsters, they've got huge bodies. The Gauls can't even bear to look them in the eye. It's too scary. And because these rumors then transfer to the Roman troops, Caesar says that he can hear his troops crying in their tents.
Mm.
Not a good look. Writing their wills. See, the Romans legalistic to the end, and they're talking even of mutiny.
Yeah.
So he's kind of got a crisis on his hands all of a sudden amongst his own troops. So what would you guess Caesar would do at this point?
Oh.
I'm in teaching mode. He makes a big speech to get his troops back on side.
Yes.
Of course, he is the inspiring leader.
It would be very inspiring.
It would. And to be fair to Caesar, we do have other evidence from people like Cicero that he was a great rhetorician.
I like to imagine that he's on horseback now, though.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. Or on a stand.
Horseback. So in Caesar's speech, how does he rouse the troops and stop them from crying in their tents and informing the next of kin?
He reminds them of the great things they've done in the past, the victories that they have had and that the Romans as a whole have had against the Germani.
Yes.
He brings up again that victory of Marius, who is, remember, his uncle by marriage, against the Cimbrian Teutoni, who are Germanic peoples. And this time he actually mentions Marius by name. All right, so this is a victory that happened, 40 odd years before. So within living memory, I suppose, or at least maybe their parents' memory. And he says the Helvetii, who we just beat, they have beaten Ariovistus before.
Yes.
The people we just conquered, they've actually managed to overcome Ariovistus, which actually contradicts what Ariovistus was said, that he's never been beaten by Gauls. So somebody's telling a porky pie there. He's saying, we've got reason on our side. We've got logic. Roman logic, he calls it ratio, all right, a working out, is better than German, than Germanic logic. Ariovistus manages to overcome the Gauls by being more strategic, I guess, than them. But our strategy is so much better. And he's still not absolutely sure that Ariovistus is going to fight, or at least conveys that he's potentially hoping that he won't. But the important thing about the speech is that, as he says himself, the spirit of all ranks was changed in a remarkable fashion. The greatest keenness and eagerness for active service was engendered.
So this just shows another aspect of Caesar, the great leader, another one of his leadership skills.
Absolutely. Yeah. In Latin, it's called the ad locutio, which is the speaking to the troops. And emperors will later often be depicted in this pose. This is a good thing for them to be seen as doing. So this is kind of the look that Caesar's giving us here.
Yeah, yeah. So at this point, Caesar gives Ariovistus one last chance to talk it out, to back down, to save his own face. So we have another negotiation with exactly the same arguments presented?
Pretty much. We're given it in a little more detail that Caesar, he kind of says to Ariovistus, look what we've done for you.
Mm.
He pretty much asks for the same things again, except he hammers home that Ariovistus owes them.
Yeah. Like how you get the little details, though, that Caesar went up with 10 men on horseback and left them a suitable distance away. Ariovistus did the same thing. So I like to imagine that they've met on a windswept hill somewhere, men in the distance with fluttering cloaks.
I see you want to make a
film. Staring each other
of this.
Down. Yeah, well, it writes itself, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It is very filmy. Do we want to go through what Ariovistus replies or just say?
Ariovistus replies with the same arguments.
Yeah. Again, he goes into a bit more detail. He says, I'm not making war, chapter 44. It's the Gauls are the ones who are making war against me. I was invited in.
And he was?
He was invited in, but not perhaps in such great numbers, and only by the Sequani.
It's like being invited to a party, but bringing your whole family.
Yeah, I think bringing your lousiest friends who are going to smash the place up by the sounds of it.
It's like a Griswold movie. You invite one person and suddenly Ariovistus and all the Germani turn up.
And of course he has multiple wives too, so there's a big family there. He also says, look, the Gauls want to give me tribute.
Mm.
Close to victim blaming. They want to give me tribute. I'm not going to refuse it. They want to pay me essentially taxes.
Yes, a protection racket.
Protection racket, yeah, yeah. That's better. Yes, that's the right phrase. Yeah, so it's very slick kind of response.
So look, Caesar tried. And Ariovistus's men are throwing rocks.
Yeah, which seems a bit petty, doesn't it? I
mean, yeah, they are.
Would
hurt. They are. They're throwing rocks. Fine. Just in case it doesn't drive home enough that this guy's just asking for it.
Yeah, and I think throwing rocks is also meant to convey that it's not even real weapons. It's kind of the savage nature coming out.
Mm-hmm.
Ariovistus says some pretty nasty things to Caesar here. He says, Caesar should back off. He's in the wrong place, technically true. If I, Ariovistus, am forced to kill you, Rome would thank me. That's pretty nasty.
Oh, man's got a point.
You're not popular back home and I guess it's a kind of reminder that you've got enemies back home, but it's meant to come over as pretty cruel and biting. Also, Ariovistus, I wonder if he actually would say this. He says to Caesar, I'm not such a barbarian that I don't know what's going on. He uses the word barbarous and he says, I'm not so ignorant that I don't know the Aedui and Romans have been helping each other out. I know that you're talking to each other behind my back, is what he says. But he calls himself a barbarian. Although in the negative, I'm not such a barbarian that I can't see that. All right? I'm not so stupid.
Yeah, but it could be a thing where, you know, if you are a barbarian, it's fine for you to call yourself a barbarian. But as soon as somebody else calls you a barbarian, then the gloves are off, you know.
Yeah, it's all complicated by the fact that this whole speech is probably invented by Caesar.
Yes.
So is that a reminder that Ariovistus is actually a barbarian? Or is he trying to say, look, this might be a barbarian, but we shouldn't underestimate him?
Okay.
I.e. Caesar saying that. He's one of the more intelligent barbarians.
Unsuccessful negotiations again for the second time. So back to their respective corners. Ariovistus's men firing arrows as they go because, you know, just to drive home the fact that they're barbarians who can't be trusted. Caesar is ready to fight, but he does send an envoy just in case Ariovistus sees sense.
One last try. Caesar sends an envoy who is, he's a Romanized Gaul. He's from a Gallic family called Gaius Valerius Procillus, the son of Gaius Valerius Caburus.
Mm.
The Caburus name, I think, is a Gallic name, but he had been granted citizenship and taken on the name of the man who'd granted him citizenship. And Caesar tells us that Procillus is brave and cultured and fluent in the Gallic language, which Ariovistus also uses, even though he's from the other side of the Rhine. Caesar also sends Marcus Metius, who apparently was a friend of Ariovistus. So he sends people who can communicate with Ariovistus, who know him, who understand him, as a kind of last-ditch attempt to talk. But it doesn't work out because when Ariovistus sees them, despite this previous friendship, he calls them over and puts them in chains.
Why come you to me to spy?
Which I suppose you might do if a battle's about to happen. It's not overly surprising. It's against the law of war, of course, if they have come as legati, if they've come as envoys. You're not meant to harm them at all.
Mm. So now we get a big battle scene, but as has been characteristic with the battles so far in Caesar's Gallic War, it's light on detail.
Yeah, we don't get an awful lot of detail except it's fierce fighting.
Yeah.
Both sides fought in spirited fashion till eventide is how it's translated in our text. So they fought the whole day until the evening.
Mm-hmm.
And they were both really going for it. Except apparently Ariovistus isn't serious in engaging. His troops apparently are, but he doesn't think he's going to win. So he's waiting for the new moon, which presumably is a good sign of fortune for him. Caesar takes advantage of this and he really goes for it. So he presses the attack. This must be Caesar interpreting it, or he's heard a rumour that Ariovistus is superstitious in this way.
Okay, and that the tidings are bad and therefore this is a good time for Caesar to press the advantage.
Yeah, he is really painting Ariovistus as superstitious there, despite the fact that, of course, the Romans were obsessed with omens. Really, the crux of the battle comes in chapter 52, where, to quote Caesar, our troops attacked the enemy so fiercely when the signal was given, and the enemy dashed forward so suddenly and swiftly, there was no time to discharge javelins upon them. So javelins were thrown aside, so they're already too close, and it was a sword fight at close quarters. But the Germani, according to their custom, speedily formed mass and received the sword attack. They're very good at absorbing the attack, apparently. Mm-hmm. Not a few of our soldiers were found brave enough to leap on to the masses of the enemy, tear the shields from their hands, and deal a wound from above. The left wing of the enemy's line was beaten and put to flight, but their right wing, by sheer weight of numbers, was pressing our line hard. Young Publius Crassus, commanding our cavalry, noticed this, and as he could move more freely than the officers who were occupied in and about the line of battle, he sent the third line in support of our struggling troops. So when we do get detail, it is quite dramatic.
Mm.
So you've got the Romans mostly holding out, but there is a danger, and they're being extremely brave. They're, you know, jumping over the Germani, over where they've massed together.
To stab downwards.
Yeah, and to rip their shields away. Ultimately, there is Roman victory, of course, as there nearly always is in these battles. A lot of Germani are killed or captured, but many of them escape back over the Rhine, including Ariovistus.
Caesar makes quite a note of the fact that Ariovistus escapes and a number of his family members, including his wives, are taken prisoner or killed.
Yeah, two wives and daughters of Ariovistus. Mentioning it here, I think, is a reminder that the Germani don't practice monogamy, very strange to the Romans. So there's a bit of ethnography going on there. And that he ran away.
That feels uncharacteristic.
I mean, some people will come in and fight to the death, but he's got kingdom back over the Rhine to be king of.
You see that Tacitus quote?
Yeah, this is from much, much later, so we better contextualise. Certainly in the later ethnographic text by Tacitus in the Germania from 98 CE, Tacitus says, to throw away one's shield is the supreme disgrace. The guilty wretch is debarred from sacrifice or council, excommunicated, ostracized.
Mm.
Men have often survived battle only to end their shame by hanging themselves. So you don't want to go back if you're defeated.
So that's characterizing the Germani of his era, whether that applies back then, and Ariovistus went and offed himself. Because we never hear of Ariovistus again after this.
No, he's kind of sent back with his tail between his legs and doesn't have to reappear. He kind of has his revenge on Caesar, though, by causing him trouble back in the Senate, I suppose. Caesar is very happy and celebratory about the fact that Gaius Valerius Procillus survives and comes back and they're reunited.
That was the man who was clapped in chains a bit earlier before the battle.
Yeah, he's still in chains when Caesar finds him, but he is at least alive. Procillus said that in his own presence the lots had been thrice consulted to see whether he should be burnt to death at once or saved for another time. Let's just emphasize the cruelty of the Germani at the end here. And Caesar, he usually ends each book, as he does here, by saying where he's going to put his troops for the winter. He winters his troops amongst the Sequani, who are the ones who've caused all this trouble by inviting in the Germani in the first place. And he leaves a man called Labienus in command. Now, he is somebody who will turn up again. He's kind of the second most important commander, and he's often left in charge in Caesar's absence. Caesar himself goes to do his winter job, which is he goes back to the bit of Gaul that's in northern Italy, and he holds the assizes, as it's always translated, which just means he has law courts. So people come to him with petitions, and he kind of does his other thing that he does as governor. It's not fighting all the time.
Yeah.
Carrying out the admin tasks.
Yeah, a bit of an anticlimactic way to end a book, like with paperwork.
Yes. Yeah, but it often is. And I guess it's dedication to duty that's being stressed at the end here. Sometimes at the end of the book, you'll get the celebration back in Rome of how wonderful Caesar is.
Mm.
But in this one, it's very much, okay, back to work, right? It's not going to be wild partying, just getting on with it.
Two capital campaigns were thus finished in a single summer, and Caesar therefore withdrew his army a little earlier than the Caesar required into winter cantonments among the Sequani,
leaving Labienus in command thereof, while he himself set off for Hither Gaul to hold the assizes. Hither Gaul for winter, what a splendid idea. And on that note, 'tis the season. Enjoy your Saturnalia. Don't do anything Caesar wouldn't do. And I'll see you next year. Ave, ave.